Hello, this is John Ailey, host of KUT's Eclecticos. You know I've been on the air in Austin for 46 years. And if we're really, really lucky, the Tribcast won't make it another 6 months. Ben Philpott made me say that. Nonetheless, here's your Tribcast crew.
And thank you very much. Welcome to the Tribcast. I'm Ben Philpott, sitting in for Reeve Hamilton, who is either with Gypsies or on a junket with the Indigo Girls. I'm not sure which.
Where is he? Morgan will know where he is.
He is at the Ghost Ranch in New Mexico at summer camp.
He is the 1%.
At summer camp.
How about
that? Reeve is the 1%.
Top bunker, bottom bunker.
You know, my kids go to summer camp, but they're also 10 and 7.
Well, there you go.
But they both look older than Reeve.
Welcome, everyone. Again, I'm Ben Philpott here with some of the regular Tribcast crew, CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Yo, Ben.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Education Reporter Morgan Smith.
Hello.
President.
President.
Newly appointed president of the Tribune.
Evan promoted me
within
yes.
the last 5 minutes.
This Tribcast.
I believe that he's only promoting you so that he can then yell at you.
Have I yelled at anybody in the entire
Let's yell at Ben. It sounds like about the time, doesn't it?
Yell at anybody.
We might have gotten it on tape.
a lot to talk about this week. We are just a week away from the runoff. In the state primaries. Everyone knows July 31st, best time to go to the polls, so that's why we're going to have it. Also, some money is missing from the state education budget. But just in case you want to know how good or crappy your schools are with or without this money, we also have a new app to talk about that the Tribune launched a few days ago. Why don't we just start with the U.S. Senate race? We've only been able to talk about it for the last year, so let's give it another week.
It's to the point now where both of the campaigns are saying it is a close race. And this is notable because David Duhurst's campaign has never said it's a close race. I don't know that they're saying it officially, but they're saying it. And, you know, they don't know whether he's going to pull this out or not. And, you know, the conversation sort of in the conventional wisdom among the people here in the Austin bubble is that this is tight, that Duhurst might be behind, that Cruz may actually be ahead in this thing. Time killed this guy, and, you know, he's struggling to make it to Tuesday.
But time was supposed to kill Cruz.
Time to get traction, I think.
But time was supposed to kill Cruz because Cruz's momentum was really right at primary day after Deb Fischer had won, after Richard Murdoch had won. The narrative nationally was turning in Cruz's favor. He makes the runoff. And then people said, well, the problem for Cruz is going to be that the bubble will deflate in the next 2 months. It hasn't. And that's partly because Cruz has done a good job and his campaign has done a good job of keeping the bubble aloft. But it's partly because the Duhurst folks have seemed unable to figure out what to do.
Well, they don't seem to be talking about anything that voters care about.
Right.
I mean, they've been on this Chinese tire dealer thing for some time now.
And the D.C. insider thing.
And, you know,
demonizing the fact that he's a lawyer, which is an interesting decision. Because
right. And, you know,
it used to just be trial lawyers. Now, apparently, all lawyers are.
Yeah, lawyer's the dirty word of the year, I guess. And you're right. The idea was that with a long 7 week lapse between the primary and the runoff, that Duhurst would have time to get his footing again and, you know, bring his forces to bear on this thing.
What about this Cash for Kids scandal thing and the Duhurst campaign's connecting Ted Cruz to it? Is that something that people are going to care about that is going to stick?
I think they're in that mode and, you know, at the end of the football game where you say everybody go long and they just throw the football up there. I think they're trying everything that's left in the notebook.
Yeah, that didn't work. They put on this ad, the Super PAC put on this ad the other day in which a woman essentially accuses Ted Cruz of killing her son. Very exaggerated.
It takes 30 seconds. It takes all 30 seconds
weirdly
of the ad just to explain the thing.
Explanation of what the ad is suggesting. And it has not gotten any traction. I think we're at a point now where there's not traction to get. The shape of the race is the shape of the race.
Well, and you know, one of the questions here is if you put up an ad like that, you're trying to convince a voter who's with Cruz to come off or convince a voter who's undecided to go to Duhurst. And the question here is whether the people who are committed to Cruz, and for that matter to Duhurst at this point, are still convincible. Are they people who've decided a long time ago and it's just like, come on, get this over with, I'm going to go vote. Are they movable voters?
I don't think this is about moving voters, though. I think in terms of, like, we're talking about deflation, you know, the bubble bursting for Cruz. The problem with Dewhurst is the deflation among those who just really don't care to come out and vote in another round of elections. And so I think Dewhurst is pushing the idea of, if you stay at home, you're going to elect someone that kills children.
There are two other problems, I think, that are actually concrete problems that are as much about the moment in which we are as anything. The first is, there are not passionate Dewhurst supporters. Passionate. Now, the minute I say that, some will come forward and say, I'm a passionate Dewhurst supporter. So obviously, I don't mean there are literally none.
Right. There's 31 I can name over on the east end of the Capitol.
But there are not passionate Dewhurst supporters to the point that there is a Dewhurst army that is poised to turn out.
Right.
Right.
There is a Cruz army.
Yeah, pitchforks and yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, and I think it's been very interesting to read between the tweets. Dewhurst supporters have tweeted at various points over the last week or two, we already have enough people who can give speeches in Washington. We want someone who has actually done something. So they're saying basically Cruz has no record, even though Cruz may talk pretty and Dewhurst is not terribly articulate. You go with the guy who actually has a record. Well, you know what? This is exactly the moment when people who have done nothing and who talk pretty are getting elected all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Cruz is, in that respect, very much caught up in this stream where politics is transforming. And I remember when George H.W. Bush, I believe in 92, in his reelection bid, was criticized for not being a terribly articulate candidate in his own defense against Bill Clinton and Ross Perot, who were both very well spoken and able to talk. And he had some line like, you know, yes, I'm not the best speaker in the world, but I hear the quiet voices that others don't. He tried to turn that to his advantage. It's very hard to do it.
Well, and,
I think that Dewhurst's inability to articulate convincingly his core beliefs, message, and all that up against Cruz, who is a better orator, has hurt Dewhurst and helped Cruz at this moment when that kind of ability to speak, record notwithstanding, is getting people elected all over the country.
Well, and you know, I would just seem impossible to me that a place in Texas where the Tea Party maybe was not born but definitely did a lot of its growing years would not at some point oust a statewide establishment candidate. I mean, of course it was going to happen at some point.
Right. You know, one of the things that's evident here is that Dewhurst has a relatively weak statewide organization. He's a candidate who's done a lot of wholesale advertising. He's spent a lot of money on TV over the years. He's done very, you know, deep and vigorous television campaigns and stuff like that. But when you sort of check around the state and say, okay, so where's the Dewhurst organization in this town and this town and this county and this county? They're weak. And the network of people for whom he has performed, you know, constituent services and things like that. You know, you go here and somebody says, oh, Rick Perry helped my family with this, or Rick Perry helped our town with that. Dewhurst doesn't have as many of those bricks laid. And here's Ted Cruz building a grassroots organization where he's basically grabbing this movement, whatever you want to call it, Tea Party, insurgents, whatever. He's basically grabbing a thing that starts with the grassroots. He's got a better ground game.
Well, and while we're talking about the system that's in place, let's back down from the statewide level and look at how this system is also affecting some of the local races and how that is then affecting Cruz's success or could affect Cruz's success on the runoff. We've got here in Central Texas, two races that Tea Party or insurgent or whatever have flavor to them, like State Senate District 25, which is from South Travis down to San Antonio. We've got the incumbent Jeff Whitworth against a Tea Party candidate, Donna Campbell. That race was...
Who was Tea Party before Tea Party was cool, be honest. Donna Campbell
She's
Betsy freaking Ross. I mean, she is not just somebody who showed up lately with a pitchfork that still has the tag and the
Betsy
plastic
F.
on
Ross
it.
In my history book.
Is that what it is?
Right.
Yeah.
And then we've got the congressional district that runs from western Travis all the way up to the Tarrant County line.
It runs from Hayes to the Tarrant County line.
Oh, does it run all the way from Hayes? Okay.
Yeah.
See, and the difference, of course, Ben, is that...
Well, I know that's my congressional district,
I don't,
too.
This is the one with Roger Williams
I think
and
that
West Ritalin.
Wentworth would probably characterize himself as not a Tea Party candidate. Not that anybody would let him get away with characterizing himself as a Tea Party candidate. Right. But I think Roger Williams, however, would probably very much object to being characterized as the establishment candidate versus Wes Riddle.
No, the finance director for George W. Bush is clearly not the establishment candidate.
but Williams is more consciously running
right.
as a different flavor of tea.
Right.
Maybe it's weaker tea. But Williams in that
Money
case
tea.
thinks he's
opportunistic.
As much a tea.
Yeah. Well. I think he's trying to. I think he, like a lot of Republicans, is trying to capitalize on this. But I think Wes Riddle is kind of the. If you look at those two candidates, that's Roger Williams is the establishment candidate in that race. Wes Riddle is the anti-establishment candidate in that race, and it's a race. It's another one of these things where you know these guys are talking to so few voters. They're engaging so few people. They're obviously talking about things that most people don't care about. 90% of us aren't going to vote, right? So they've gotten to the point where they're talking to this very small group, and the innervated part, the activated part of this group is this group that's kind of looking at it and saying, we can knock off some of the establishment here. Let's go get them.
And this was a race that was – this was a district that was supposed to be – it was supposed to go to a runoff. They had, what, 12, yeah. 11 people in the
right.
in the primary.
Right.
But it was supposed to be two establishment candidates in the runoff.
Well, they thought it'd be a North and a South candidate. They thought, you know, this is the district that goes from Fort Worth basically to the Austin Metro. And they thought they'd get a candidate out of the Austin Metro and a candidate out of, you know,
didn't they?
The Metroplex or someplace close to
well,
that.
Well, Roger Weatherford Williams I would describe as the Metroplex candidate.
Right, right. Fort Worth, you know, basically a Fort Worth car dealer. Right.
And where's Wes Riddle from?
You know, he's kind of not from here. He's kind of from West Point. I mean, you know, he was Army. He's been a West Point instructor. He's done some of that. But he's basically from Central Texas. He's not from Austin. I think he's from north of here, but not really geographically centered in the same way. You know, it wasn't a Dave Garrison. It wasn't a Michael Williams. It wasn't, you know, one of the candidates that, you know.
So you think this race is a toss-up?
I do.
And you're from San Antonio, Morgan, mm-hmm. President Smith.
Yes.
You understand the Wentworth Campbell race probably as well as anybody here. What do you think about that?
I think that Wentworth is in trouble. I think he's been working pretty hard, but I think that now that we're in this runoff, that Donna Campbell has really started to generate some steam, and so it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
And of course, as you alluded to, the fact that you have the Senate race drawing a lot of Cruz
right.
people. To
well,
the
right,
poll.
Yeah. If you show up for Cruz,
there aren't a whole lot of Cruz Wentworth voters.
Right. If you show up for Campbell, you're probably a Cruz voter.
Yeah, there might be more Cruz Williams right. voters, but I suspect that there are not very many Cruz Wentworth voters
and
or Dewhurst Campbell voters.
And in right. that Senate district, you've got, you know, the four counties that Donna Campbell won are all either more rural or it's the very southern portion of Travis County.
Right.
She all won them easily, and she all won them with a lot of Tea Party
right, but
support.
The population in Bear County. So if Wentworth won Bear County and she won everything else, could he still win this thing or not?
Yes. If he won it by significant enough margins. But he's not winning it by significant enough margins.
And those are the same voters that Dewhurst is like, oh, please come back to the polls in this runoff.
Right.
I mean, that may be a bit of a stretch, but that's... It's the ones that aren't passionate about it, but, you know, may or may not come back to vote.
Campbell was unexpectedly strong, I guess to the Wentworth people, was unexpectedly strong between Travis and Bear counties and all that middle district. And it's because that overlapped to some extent the old Lloyd Doggett district where she ran 2 years ago.
And
she ran against
she also
Lloyd Doggett,
kind of from down the
well,
there-ish.
She's from Columbus. Yeah. She's from Columbus, which is, you know, a little bit east of
it's
all
the
of this.
The crook in the 71 to 10
right.
on a Houston.
But she's a known quantity in that part of yeah. the of Central Texas, and that part of Central Texas has sort of been the hotbed of these anti-insurgent Republican voters.
Let me say again, if you have a Senate that next time, instead of Jeff Wentworth and Steve Ogden, and Florence Shapiro, and Chris Harris, and Wendy Davis, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm leaving one more out who is not coming back.
Mike Jackson.
And Mike Jackson. Now instead has Kelly Hancock, Ken Paxton, Larry Taylor, Mark Shelton, Donna Campbell.
Charles Shortner. It's a different Senate.
It is a different Senate. Suddenly, the Corona Seliger, L-Type Duncan wing is the wing on the fringe.
Well, and there's
the mainstream wing is the wing that is currently now not the majority of the majority party. And it's. I think the legislative session next session is going to be vastly different as a consequence of this.
And the Senate race gets to determine whether whatever that majority is can assert itself or not. If they're either replacing Dewhurst or they're not. If Dewhurst wins this race, then they'll be replacing Dewhurst. And the numbers that you're talking about in that new conservative pack that you're talking about may have a lot to say about who the next lieutenant governor is. If it's Dewhurst, then it's...
Right, of course, you're assuming that if Dewhurst loses the Senate race, that he remains in the job.
I am.
Yeah, but you're right. And I think, again, the dynamic, this is all stuff that's related. Are there any other races? The Felicia Harris, Randy Weber...
Yeah, there's some other good races.
There are other runoffs where the outcome is going to have some bearing potentially on turnout for the big Senate race.
Yeah, we've got a couple of congressional races. We've got the Gallego Ciro Rodriguez race, but that's Democrats. So we're looking mostly at Republican races. So we've got
we have the Democrats on the Senate side as well.
Right.
Yarborough and Sadler.
And you don't take it as a given Sadler wins.
I don't. I don't think enough people know enough about that race to do much more than throw a dart at the
board. Or that there's a race.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that there's a runoff at all, given the, you know, sort of the platforms and the relative seriousness of the candidates, not to say Grady Yarbrough is not a serious candidate, but in a normal election year.
Oh, hell, I'll say Grady Yarbrough is not a serious candidate.
I mean, but
it defies reality to say that he isn't, that he is a serious candidate, I think.
But to, you know, the Democratic voters, it was equals, right? So
the Democratic voters voted for a name.
Right.
They didn't vote for a platform.
Right.
They didn't vote for a candidacy.
So do you like the way Grady looks on paper or the way Paul looks on paper? I think that's a toss-up. I think that's a dartboard race. There's the Weber race. There's the...
Well, there are some of these House races that I'm not certain the locus of these House races is going to generate enough turnout to make a difference. The Sid Miller race, the Trent McKnight... was that? Is Hobson? No, it's Clardy and Hobson.
Clardy and Hobson.
McKnight is running against...
I'm blanking.
Yeah,
Drew Springer.
But there are some runoffs.
Right. There are some runoffs.
Stephanie Click and Ken Sapp.
Right. They're
the
not high turnout
races. The
panhandle
that you like, that race, Lantrup and Ken King, right?
Right.
That's what you think is an interesting race.
Right.
I do too.
But I don't think that these are the kinds of races that get a bunch of people out. And I think any area that has more than 1 in 10 voters shows up is going to be extraordinary. You know, and I just don't see it. I think, you know, on Friday night, all of us, except for Evan, are going to start watching the Olympics, and you know.
Right, because I don't care, because I'm not patriotic.
Well, there you go. So,
I'm pretty sure I saw that on AgendaWise a few months ago.
I'm sure
you did. AgendaWise every day.
Well, I'm sure.
I just am not interested
but
in
I'm
the
just,
Olympics.
I'm just saying it's a huge distraction.
I'm going to just watch the whole season of Homeland over and root for the redheaded guy who's working for Al-Qaeda. That's what I'm going
to do. Well, 90% of us aren't going to vote, and you know, 100%, you know. 99.9% of those 90% are going to be watching the Olympics instead of this election. I just don't think there's a draw here.
I got to say, I have no idea how to make this jump from the Olympics to $300 million
well,
lost
wait, before,
out of school
budget. Before you do, I want to say, because we won't be on the podcast until after this has already happened, we are going to have an election night scoreboard again.
Right.
Similar, if you liked what you saw on primary night, if you appreciated the porting in of real-time results on all those races, are there 37 races?
There's 37 runoffs, right?
We will have live as they get results porting into a dashboard similar to that. So come back to the Tribune site on Tuesday night to keep up with those races.
So let's try to keep up with $300 million in the school budget. Apparently, we were supposed to have it, and now, thanks to Morgan, the only great education reporter in the state, I believe.
Twice she was promoted to president.
President, exactly. We now know that $300 million is iffy at best.
And was it money that was already allocated, or was it money that after the fact was allocated and then was unallocated?
I'm not sure I understand the difference between those two, but it's money that... It was money that was already allocated. It was written into the budget in HB1 as a contingent appropriation. But then in SB2, during the special session, lawmakers went ahead and subtracted that amount from general revenue. So it wasn't, it basically made it not a contingent appropriation because that money was already taken out of the budget.
So subsequent to the session, the money was then appropriated or promised.
They assumed they were getting the
money.
If
the money was taken away, if this constitutional amendment passed, which would allow the school land board to then transfer this money, the school land board, which operates out of the general land office, decided that they weren't going to transfer this $300 million, that they saw investments coming up in the future that they wanted to protect the fund for. So now we don't have $300 million in the public education budget for this biennium, which, given, is it's a fraction of the $34 billion that's in there for K through 12 education right now. But it's still another little thing that lawmakers are going to have to look at in January when they decide to do supplemental appropriations.
Is there any way to tell what gets cut?
No, there's not, because this was going to the Foundation School Program, which is the money that goes out to all the school districts through the funding formulas. So this is, you know, this is not allocated it's not, say, towards pre-K or towards remedial programs. This is just general money that schools use to operate every day.
But it looks like it's just another, like you just said, this, it's another one of those things you're going to have to tack on to the supplemental appropriation, which already includes $5-6 billion in Medicaid spending. And
I just did some iPhone calculator app math. $300 million.
The story you're about
divided
to hear.
By 1,300 school districts. Is that correct? The number of school districts, 1,300.
Yeah, well, 11 is, a little bit
is
less,
about $231,000 per district on
nothing.
Average, which is not nothing. And of course, that's on average.
Right.
So, you know, for AISD, that's a rounding error. For the Mejia School District, it's real money. And, and of course, not everyone's going to get assessed the same cut.
Well, luckily,
out of that
the school
group.
Districts all have reserves that they need to be spending anyway.
I think I saw a spreadsheet about I saw a spreadsheet about this during the session about how much school districts had on
here. So, but again, they did not expect this money was in the budget until the land board indicated to them that they were going to transfer it. I mean, I'm trying to understand
so they wrote the budget,
a cut or a broken promise.
They put a $300 million in the budget. Correct me where I'm wrong here, Maureen.
Okay.
They put $300 million in the budget and said, you may spend this if the money becomes available. And the money can only become available if, A, the voters pass this constitutional amendment allowing the land board to spend this money, and, B, the land board says, yeah, that's a good idea, let's spend the money. So the voters did, the land board didn't, and so the money's not available.
That's right. And so that was the way it was in the budget. And then once that was written into the budget during the special session, lawmakers came back and said, okay, we're basically counting on this money coming from the land board, so we're going to take that equivalent money out of general revenue so we can put it somewhere else, was basically what happened.
So they basically reassigned the $300 million to something else.
Right.
And what does the land board say? What was the exact reason why they didn't do this? They decided that it wasn't fiscally prudent?
They had a chance to invest in the next Superman movie, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Commissioner Patterson said that, you know, we see a lot of important future investments coming up. We don't have to make this payment. And we think right now the best decision to preserve the health of the fund is to keep this money back and not spend it. So...
And what did the education commissioner say about this? Oh, there isn't one.
Right.
There's a backstory here too, because the controller has been noting as she went along that tax revenue is way higher than she predicted it would be, and so prospects are, that the money is arguably available, even if the land commission doesn't come up, even if this land board doesn't come up with it. Susan Combs and Jerry Patterson are political rivals at the moment, and in not spending
rivals,
the money.
Rivals is the PG way to say it.
Well, okay. children listen to this podcast.
And then there's this other backdrop to it, which is there's always this tug of war between the legislature, the State Board of Education, and to some extent the General Land Office over what money gets put into this available school fund, because every dollar that goes into the available school fund is money that the legislature doesn't have to spend out of general revenue on education. And so, I mean, this is something that happens at the start of every legislative session. Now it has just kind of dragged out until, July of the first year of the biennium, and we see that there's this $300 million gap.
Right. They'll have a moment and Ben referred to this. They're going to have a moment at the beginning of the next session in 2013 when the legislature goes, okay, look at what our obligations are and how far short of our obligations we are. And they'll write a supplemental appropriations bill. They already knew that would be a big bill because it included
Medicaid,
which, depending on which estimate you listen to, and these estimates have gone down, by the way, $4 to $6 billion. Now it's down to, I think, $3.4 billion. They're going to have to write a check for Medicaid. Apparently, they're going to have to write a check for schools. And Patterson and some of the others will argue that Combs has said tax revenues are up, so you probably do have the money, legislature, if you want to spend it on the
But so what happens in the state Senate, which is going to be much more conservative?
Well, right. You have a political problem. So maybe your economics problem is solved because you got the money, but you got a political problem.
Yeah, the math problem's okay.
The political problem is that the pressure from the right on a lot of these elected officials, especially with the 2014 elections and the primaries in view, is don't put money back into public education. You cut public education. You frankly probably didn't cut it enough. All the cries of doom and gloom that would happen as a consequence of the cuts in the last session have largely been avoided. That's arguable, but that's the position of some of the people on the right putting pressure on these elected officials. They're going to have a hemorrhage if there is a move afoot to put money back into public ed.
Right.
Now, of course, many of the constituents of these same elected officials would like to see that happen. But politically, it's a challenge for
them to do. Constituents have to show that there's consequences, which has yet to happen.
And only 1 in 10 is voting.
Yeah.
So obviously, the electorate, you know, whether they're right or not is, you know, subject to a philosophical argument. But, you know, they're not engaged in this. They're not playing. So the legislature's standing at the checkout line. They've got a basket full of stuff. And they've got a choice of either take some stuff out of your basket or come up with some more money. And right now, these guys, this current legislature, and as you say, a lot of the people getting elected now, are saying, you know, take stuff out of the basket.
Mm-hmm. And so this $300 million, it could come back as a supplemental appropriation, but there's nothing requiring that the legislature makes that as a supplemental appropriation in January. So, I mean, compared to the billions that we already owe in Medicaid, the $2.4 billion that we already owe in deferred payments to public schools, I mean, it kind of seems like $300 million could just fall through the cracks.
Yeah, there's an environmental question here, and that's this. In January, what do the legislators and lawmakers think voter temperature is on education cuts and on education spending? And if they think that the electorate is ticked off and wants them to, you know, keep that in their basket and pay for it, then they'll come up with this appropriation.
And then the other part of this I would point out, and Morgan is getting at some of this, and I agree with her on this, is that this is, as they say, an election time, not a referendum, but a choice. It's not, do we put the money into public ed or don't we? It's, do we take the money that we have available and put it into public ed, or do we do something else with it? For instance, coming out of the worst one-year drought in the history of the state of Texas, we have an unfunded water plan whose cost, as I understand it, is about a sixth of the amount of money we're talking about right now for public ed. So if you're looking at the immediacy of that problem, do you go, that's got to be moved to the top of the list of priorities?
Right.
I mean, you know, it's going to be an interesting time. Now, look, if the comptroller is correct and the doomsayers with regard to the 83rd session are wrong, and rather than having a shortfall on the order of what we had last time, or even a shortfall at all, which I think there are some people, total optimists, are saying maybe no shortfall.
Well, okay, go ahead.
Right, maybe.
Depends on what the formulas look like.
is the conversation about another austerity session irrelevant?
If the budget was balanced now, all of that would be right. Revenues are ahead of where they were supposed to be. If we weren't owing dollars, then we would say all of these revenues that are ahead of where they're supposed to be are good for the next budget. But in fact, we are owing dollars. We've got this Medicaid hole. We've got this education hole. There's some other holes. And the question is, have revenues grown quickly enough to cover the hole or to cover the hole and then some?
And you have a governor and other members of the legislature who have said we're not going to have any more revenue of any kind next session.
Well, and that may be right. It may be that all this extra money that came in from fracking or from whatever is just money that covers the remaining obligations of the budget they wrote a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Well, all right, Morgan, you got 15 seconds to tell us about the school app.
Well, it's amazing.
It is fantastic.
That was five seconds.
Time's up. Texas Tribune has a new data app that they launched a few days ago, which essentially gives you all the things you need to know about how your school district is performing and demographics on teachers and the students and blah, 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 blah. So it's a very comprehensive, great app.
And sell it. Blah, 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 blah.
Sorry. Yada, yada, yada.
Well,
it was awesome.
It's... Okay. Well, it's basically, it's all the information that the TEA has collected on school districts, that the comptroller's office has collected on school districts, dating back to, in some cases, 2003, that you can go in and basically look up, you know, how much teachers are getting paid, what their experience compares to other teachers in the state, what the demographics at your school look like, what the academics look like at your school. And we've made it very, very easy to understand. So if there's a term that you don't understand, all you have to do is scroll over it and a definition will pop up. Another really cool feature is a visualized feature, so you can see what the trends look like over the years, and it's just, I mean, it's really exciting to see it.
And you were cool. saying this is all information that's within either TEA or the comptroller's website, but the point is that you can understand it on this.
Yeah, the thing is that this has, I mean, this data has always been available, but just very difficult to understand and to access. Even, you know, as a reporter covering public education, I still have to call up the TEA and say, hey, can you tell me where to find this on your website? Because so now it's all in one place at the Texas Tribune.
Pretty cool.
It I know we highlighted it over at KUT, and it's a really great app. I've already looked up my kids' school so that I can get my pitchfork ready in case I need it. I actually don't. They have a really good elementary school. But it's
Well, you are the 1%, Ben.
Yes.
Like Reeve.
Well, yeah, but I don't get to go see the Indigo Girls every 2 months like he does. But I don't have them on speed dial like he does. Although, like Reeve, I have delivered another mediocre podcast to you, the listeners here, out in the world. You think people listen to us around the world?
Are you filling out time, Ben?
I'm wrapping up,
as you can tell. Ben, Philpott is a radio professional. Right?
Well, thanks. You've wasted another perfectly good half hour listening to the Texas Tribune podcast. On behalf of Evan Smith and Ross Ramsey and Morgan Smith, I'm Ben Philpott. If you have any questions, email us at tribcast. Wait a minute, what is it? I'm going to get to Todd. I know everyone's pointing. It's email us at tribcast
President
at texastribune.org. Thanks to Todd, our wonderful engineer, who will somehow make this sound good. I'm Ben Philpott. We'll talk to you next week.
Nonetheless, here's your Tribcast crew.
Tribcast, sorry.
Okay. Nonetheless, here's your Tribcast view.
Tongue twister. Tribcast.